Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Celia Farber, and so excited about the show today. It's going to be a somewhat unusual show for us, a show about science, the light side and the dark side. Before I started doing this show with Christina for a couple of decades, I was primarily in print, and you may almost say obsessive focus was to chronicle the real scientists of the world. Primarily American scientists was who I had access to. The way some photographers want to photograph the snow leopard and they wait in the snow forever to get the one. I was fascinated by the concept of the unbreakable, incorruptible, true scientist in an age where science was clearly becoming it's a crude term, but whorehouse. One of the scientists that I had the absolute honor to interview, who helped me along the way as I began to go down the very dark road of everything that was wrong with HIV and AIDS research, is our guest today, Dr. David Raznick, who is joining us from North Carolina. And I'm going to read. So first of all, David is not just an outstanding and fascinating scientist who can tell us so much about cancer. We're going to dip into AIDS just a little bit, but we're really going to talk about cancer today and what he knows and a fascinating book he has just finished writing. But I want to just actually read his bio that I asked him to send me so you get a sense of the scope of Dr. David Raznick. Dave received a PhD in chemistry from Georgia Tech in 1978 with BS degrees in biology and chemistry. He worked 20 years as a pharmaceutical biotech industry in the pharmaceutical biotech industry developing drugs against cancer, emphysema, arthritis, and parasites. In 1996, he left drug development to collaborate with Professor Peter Duisberg at the University of California at Berkeley on AIDS and the chromosomal basis of cancer. He has 42 scientific publications. This is just amazing. And two published books: The Chromosomal Imbalance Theory of Cancer. I can't even say this word. Autocatalyzed Progression of Aneuploidy is Carcinogenesis. And the 2008 novel Germ of Lies. He is currently seeking a publisher for his new book for the general reader. It's called Elephants in the Lab, A Personal Odyssey into the Essence of Cancer. And stay with me, I'm not done yet, because this I really want you to hear also about Dave Raznick. This is from the preface to Elephants in the Lab. And I just love this passage. To understand something deeply is a transcendent joy. It can also be a political act. Wow. As much as possible, I want to share this experience with everyone. A good friend suggested I include my personal experiences. His excellent advice struck the right chord in me. I had thought for years that the human and political sides of this decades-long odyssey were as intriguing and essential as understanding the essence of cancer itself. The politicization of science in the 1980s turned me into a dissident scientist. Going down that road led unexpectedly to the most important and satisfying scientific work of my life. Here I present the combined results of more than a century of on-again, off-again efforts to understand what cancer really is, how it comes about, and what to do about it. My goal is to demystify the whole process and make it accessible to all. Along the way, you'll learn about the personal and professional costs of confronting dogma. This part really got me. Lost friendships, relentless personal attacks, and attempts at the highest levels of government to punish and silence dissent. this is exactly why I felt so excited for so many years to have access to this particular voice of chronicling American science, and also why my peers in media all around me seemed not so excited to talk to Dr. David Resnick. But we are, Christina and I, Christina joins us by phone today, very, very excited to welcome Dr. David Resnick to the Whistleblower Newsroom. Dave, are you there?
Celia, it's good to hear your voice. Yes, I am definitely here.
That was a long runway, but we have a long runway, you and I.
We do. And, I mean, you understand intimately the things that I wrote about because you lived it yourself in your own way.
I did. And I found myself, getting almost choking up here, looking at just preparing for the show today and sort of going. I live with the whole experience somewhere outside of me or to the side of me. That's what the brain does with trauma, you know. But I'm remembering now, and I'm remembering not just the trauma, the abuse, the loss, but the, like I said in the intro, I chose it. I chose to pursue you guys as my, you are what I wanted to photograph in print, so to speak. I wanted to know what it's like to really be a scientist and to really be excited about what you find. And no matter what you're offered in what I called the whorehouse, you're not going to veer away from it. That's actually a very inspiring thing to be around. So let's jump in. Christina, yeah. First of all, are you with us?
Sorry. Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yes, I am. With bated breath, I'm waiting to hear what happened here.
Yeah. It's.
Well, I can tell you, this is, listening to you, Celia, and over the decades that we've known each other and gone through many of these experiences, it's all of a sudden I'm getting a little bit choked up because it's like it's reliving stuff. And it's very, very emotional. And we've all paid a price, but frankly, I wouldn't change a bit of it because it's we've gone the right way. We've gone down the right path.
Well, yeah, our what we've learned is very hard earned, and I know the listeners are itching to hear because cancer, AIDS is let's face it. What's the right word to choose? Well, it dominated everybody's psyche a couple of decades ago when it was all over the newspapers and they told everybody they were all going to get it, which was part of the big lie, which we cracked and tried to demystify, and then they crushed us. And anyway, cancer, by contrast, affects almost every American family. So let's jump in right there. Dave, tell us first. And you and I discussed this yesterday, where we're gonna just speak to the layperson who knows and frankly cares very little perhaps about the ins and outs of cancer research. But what has our government been up to with all its hundreds of billions, and where has it gotten them, and where are we now in cancer research? Sorry for that huge question, but we start there?
No, actually, that's where it's all at right now. AIDS and cancer are both individually trillion-dollar industries.
Oh, I said billions. It's trillion. Oh, my God.
Trillion-dollar industries. And that alone right there tells anybody who's been following political corruption and scandals, when you're talking about magnitudes that large, you know that there's a lot of shenanigans going on, a lot of interested parties and pressures, and they'll do anything to protect it. And cancer, well, first of all, I want to make a quick link for the listeners why we talk about, you and I are mentioning AIDS and cancers here, cancer. I would have never worked on cancer with Peter Duesberg had it not been for the HIV debacle, where I would have gone probably merrily along making inhibitors for those various diseases that you talked about earlier, until I found out there was something seriously wrong in science back in the mid-1980s. When my colleagues, when I started talking to them about AIDS being doesn't appear to be contagious, they wouldn't talk to me. And anybody who's ever been around a scientist very long knows that we love to talk about what we do. And all of a sudden, they'd clam up. Colleagues that I had collaborations with for years wouldn't talk to me about AIDS. And even one fellow who was a parasitologist at University of California at San Francisco and I, we've collaborated for a number of years very successfully, and we mutually agreed in order to maintain our collaboration, we would not talk about AIDS. Now, that was a very, very profound experience for me as a scientist because I'd been very naive. I didn't know about all the political powers and pressures put on people. I was industrial scientist, and these other guys are academics. They experience the pressure a lot quicker and sooner than the industrial people do. And I started looking into that. And that led me to where I am to this day, trying to understand why it was that scientists all of a sudden wouldn't talk about something.
And so the evidence for AIDS not being infectious struck you as convincing early on, but you also noticed that it wigged out your colleagues. I'm sure you never got that emotional about any of his parasites.
No.
well, wait a second, though. I mean, if you showed him the evidence, right? I mean, you conducted experiments that showed what you were saying was correct, right?
They wouldn't listen. They would not talk.
They didn't even want to see it?
They shut down completely, Christina.
They shut down completely. There was no discussion whatever. Zero.
So let's just talk about this for a moment. Because Christina's talking about science. Yeah. And you're talking, what happens here is where science ends and something else kicks in. It's the CIA has a term, PSYOP, psychological operation. That's a word I would put on the table. A psychological operation is when they've used the mass media to guilt trip and dominate, and make everybody, it's going on right now. We're not going to get into it, but climate change. Now, the model may be correct. I haven't looked into it. But what we do know is that friendships can break down over without. This is AIDS was like that. It was emotional. It was loaded.
I guess what I'm trying to say here, Celia, is that the public's impression or general impression of scientists is that everybody is, trying to figure out what's going on here with this AIDS or whatever. There were the trillions, as you say, millions of dollars were spent on research. And here's a scientist who comes up with a provable, through his provable, his experiments, proof that AIDS, is not a contagious disease, and everybody runs away from him. That sounds very bizarre. Okay.
Well, let me give you a better example. A president of South Africa, former President Thabo Mbeki, in 2000, got two-thirds of a panel from the mainstream AIDS researchers from around the world, principally the USA, and one-third of critics such as myself and others. And the Clinton administration totally torpedoed that effort of Thabo Mbeki. That's documented.
Do you know I saw them with my own eyes? I remember vividly sitting in the corridor and these two men in dark, shiny suits came rather thundering down the corridor. And somebody said they're from the Clinton administration and they were there to try to stop the meeting you all were having inside. Okay, we're getting away from our, we're not getting away. Actually,
it's
all connected. But what I want to try to stay focused on is, AIDS not being infectious was, let's say, a political taboo at the time when you and your colleague were, let's just leave it at that, right? It was politically incendiary to say that because you were supposed to say everyone can get it, everyone's going to get it. Any broken condom can cause it. That was what you were supposed to believe, and that was categorically not true. So give us one statistic, if you would, that tells us why were you all right and they were wrong about AIDS being infectious.
There's a horde of examples. What would be the best one?
Put you on the spot. Anyone will do.
All right. There's a host of them. The AIDS epidemic is, to this day, in San Francisco, is still restricted to the same city blocks that it was in 1984. Well, hemophiliacs, for example, you know, were supposedly got AIDS, but they never got Kaposi sarcoma.
Oh, I've got one. I've got one. Jeffrey right? Epstein is a name that a lot of people, a lot of people are talking about. He was had the male version of what is it called when women are hypersexual? Sorry, it's called what's the word for a woman who...
Nymphomania?
Thank you. He had the male version of that. I actually read it's an under-publicized article all about this. So he had that. So we know he was running this sex trafficking ring and having sex with girls 3, 4, 5 times a day. So where is this STD when it comes to a figure like Jeffrey Epstein or a figure like a Bill Clinton or, for that matter, a Mick Jagger or anybody in our cultural history who's known to have a lot of sex? Weren't they supposed to get this STD?
Yeah, I got another one. There's two different definitions for AIDS. If you live in the industrialized world, HIV is crucial to the definition. If you live in Africa or other similar places, HIV is not even part of the definition. Fever, diarrhea, persistent cough, weight loss, and TB. That's the definition of AIDS in Africa.
Yep.
They don't even do HIV tests on Africans.
And when we crossed Africa, Joan Shenton, Harvey Bailey, and myself, we all know each other, for a month from west to central to east Africa, we kept saying, show us AIDS. And we went to the hospitals, we went to the villages. They showed us tuberculosis, they showed us malaria, they showed us, the TB and malaria.
Yeah, tropical
and we
diseases.
Said, tropical, we said, why are you calling this AIDS? And they said, well, we call everything AIDS here. It's a formula. And what that meant was that's where the funding came from.
So we
that is so shocking.
So we promised you and I, Dave, we weren't going to go down the rabbit hole of AIDS. But so AIDS wakes you up. AIDS puts you on the path of, shall we say...
being skeptical, being curious.
Being a dissident scientist, as you said.
I became a dissident at some point. I was just curious. I even worked on designing HIV protease inhibitors in 1984. You know, I thought these... people knew what they were talking about. And then I realized 1985, there's problems here. It doesn't seem to be contagious. They just got the wrong virus, the wrong cause or whatever. And I started reading everything I could about AIDS in those days. I had this huge library of books on AIDS. And then I discovered this guy named Peter Duisberg in some of these books. And I was reading about him. And I laid my hands on some of his work, his papers. You know, this guy's a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He identified the genome of the first retrovirus and discovered the first oncogene, for which he became a member of the National Academy of Sciences and would have got the Nobel Prize for it. But he said these things can't possibly cause AIDS. And he lost his funding.
Oh, you mean cause cancer?
Cause AIDS, you know.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the oncogene.
Yeah, the RAS oncogene, the viruses. You know, was a retrovirus. HIV is a retrovirus. And so he was an expert on retroviruses, and he said that these viruses could not cause AIDS.
Right. But so just to be clear, he first said, my oncogene can't cause cancer. And then he said, your retrovirus can't cause AIDS.
Yeah, he had a, he discovered there were some retroviruses that caused cancer in a few birds, and Ralph's sarcoma virus, and he discovered that it was a retrovirus, and they had three basic gene groups. And it turns out these HIV is a retrovirus with the same three gene groups, and he's an authority on this particular virus that is a class of virus, one of which is called HIV and claimed to cause AIDS. And he said there's no way this virus could cause AIDS. I mean, the world's leading authority on retroviruses said retrovirus cannot cause AIDS. And then I said, that should be the end of it. And it wasn't the end of it. Where I got politically activated. The world's leading authority on retrovirus has said retrovirus cannot cause AIDS. And I'm saying, what's going on here? And I got really, I wanted to find out what was going on, and I did.
So when did you first meet Peter Duisberg?
I believe it was 1993, but I really met him officially, I guess, when I left the pharmaceutical industry in 1996, and I introduced myself, basically invaded his lab and his life, and been collaborating with him ever since. Best decision I ever made in my life, where we started working on AIDS together, writing publications on that. And then towards the end of 1996, he couldn't get any grant funding anymore, so he had some money in Germany. A friend invited him there to go on sabbatical. That's when Peter decided to start working on aneuploidy theory, the chromosomal imbalance theory of cancer. And we talked about that at a coffee shop near the campus right before he left, a couple of weeks before he went to Germany, about this aneuploidy stuff. And he went there, and I stayed and went to the library and started learning about unbalanced chromosomes. And that started the whole ball rolling on our work on cancer, which led to the modern chromosomal imbalance theory of cancer, which is the explanation of cancer. It really is. And that's what my first book was about for researchers. And this current book, The Elephants in the Lab, is telling the same story, but for the public, the general reader, so that they can understand what cancer is, why the chemotherapy and things like that don't work, why screens are a very bad idea.
Okay, let me corner you right there. What is cancer? Right. You said so the public can understand what cancer right. is. So tell us, right. Dave, what is okay. cancer?
Cancer is an unbalanced combination of chromosomes. Humans, normal humans, have 46 chromosomes in all our cells. We're born that way, and they're very healthy. Unless you're Down syndrome, you have 47. Cancer cells have typically 60 to 90 chromosomes. And they're all scrambled and unbalanced, and no two cancer cells are alike. Those unbalanced chromosomes screw up everything inside the cell. Most of these cells die, but some of them can survive. And when they do, then they can become invasive. And everything that we know about cancer, everything that is known about cancer, is explained by these by the progression of these unbalanced chromosomes as the cells divide. Everything, drug resistance, spontaneous remission, everything. There's not a thing about cancer that I'm aware of that is not explained by the chromosomal imbalance theory of cancer.
So if that theory is, if you've proven that theory through, you know, experimentation that has, you know, repeated and whatever,
yeah.
I'm sure
mm-hmm.
you've done what scientists do, then what you have found, does it point to possible areas of treatment?
Yes. Yes,
and
it
what
does.
Would those
because
be?
The thing is that once you know what you're up against, what cancer is, these cancer cells, they're aneuploid. That's the fancy technical short word for unbalanced chromosomes. There
okay.
is no cancer that is not aneuploid. That's the key. And the other thing is that these cells that have unbalanced chromosomes, these aneuploid cells, which all cancer cells are, they're damaged cells. They're not as viable or hardy as the normal cells. That's why it takes decades for them to turn into cancer if they ever do. And
okay.
it also explains why a person can get over cancer with no treatment at all. It's called spontaneous remission because these wimpy cancer cells just die off on their own. The chemotherapy and radiation, almost anything, really. You don't need these poisons. Just about anything you do to a cancer cell will kill off these cells in droves because they are so wimpy. The problem is that there's no two cancer cells alike. They don't have anything in common except unbalanced chromosomes, and every one of them is different.
Right.
And there will always be a subset that will be resistant to any toxic drug, and they'll come back with a vengeance, usually, and kill you. Now, you asked me an approach that you could attempt that would take advantage of this. The key is, I call it the perturbation theory. You don't want to harm the patient. The patient or the person or the host with the cancer, their cells, you want to keep them as healthy as you possibly can, because they're already much healthier than the cancer cells, which want to die off spontaneously anyway.
Mm.
Chemotherapy and radiation reduce that difference between the health of your body and the cancer. You're killing yourself at the same time that you're killing the cancer with
right.
those toxic therapies. You can't. That's not the way to approach cancer. You will never succeed. No, there's no way that that approach will ever succeed, and it hasn't. What you have to do is maintain the health of the host, and then exercise the host. You heard of really physical exercise. Change your diet.
Yep.
Believe it or not, fever is very anti-cancer. Fevers are known to cure cancer. They shouldn't be so tightly controlled in people that have cancer. And so there's non-toxic approaches that are being used around the world. Things called hyperthermia, for example, where you wrap a person up and you heat them up a little bit,
mm-hmm.
or colistoxin, where they give these inactivated bacterial toxins that cause very high fevers. To this day, colistoxin has the highest cure rate of any therapy, and it's not used in the United States.
Where is it used?
It's used in Germany.
I knew you were going to say Germany,
Germany right now, is leading the world in the ability to diagnose and track cancer at the earliest stages, the most accurate way there is, and also in the non-toxic therapies of hyperthermia, diet, all sorts of ways. Yeah, Germany is very good at that. When people come to me and they say, where do you go? And I say, in the U.S.? Well, frankly, I don't know, but I say, if you can, go to Germany or even Mexico. They have some good places in Mexico, too. Now, I'm not a physician. I'm a scientist.
Right.
But I've followed this stuff, and I've collaborated with people, and especially a fellow in Germany who's developed an automated method of detecting and following chromosomal imbalance. It is a foolproof way of determining, without a doubt, whether or not cancer is present, precancer,
cancer is present or not.
So
in a person who has no reason to think they have cancer, but they want to be on top of their screening, they could take this test?
I wouldn't do that. The screening is another thing that is a serious problem. Screening is a population phenomenon. You try to, screen, we have 330 million Americans, and you probably want to screen most adults or most women. There's about 55 million women every year that get pap smears. Or even more than that, so you're talking about large numbers of people, but yet there's only about 12,000 cervical cancers every year when you're screening 55 million women. Almost all of the positives are false positives because of that.
Oh, wow, really?
You see, that's true of all screening, whether it's colonoscopies, whether it's pap smear, CT scans for breast cancer, anything. Almost all positives are false positives, but unfortunately, the false positives, you can't. The current ways that are used, certainly in the United States, it's very difficult to determine whether it's a false positive or a true positive. It takes a long time. Using those methods that they use them actually here in the United States too, but not nearly as extensively as they do in Germany, where they look at the chromosomes and then you can sort out the ones that are clearly not cancer from the ones that are cancer.
What if you have cancer? What if you're diagnosed with a tumor, for example?
Yeah, okay. As of right now, the only way that the standard methods to treat cancer that has a chance of actually really curing cancer is surgery. If you have a tumor that is localized, it has not been metastasized, and you cut it out, you don't leave anything there, you're cured. You real, honest to God, cured. The chemotherapy and radiation are hopeless. They should not be used. Right.
I've seen that firsthand. Two of my sisters died of ovarian cancer within 6 months of each other, and I've never seen such a savage way to go.
Your listeners should lay their hands on this book by Azra Raza, first name, R-A-Z-A. She lives in New York. She's an oncologist. She's been treating patients for, I think, over 3 decades. She wrote a book called The First Cell. She's written a recent article just last year in the New York Times about how horrible it is. People ought to stop using these damn drugs. And this is an oncologist saying this. Her husband.
And did they come after her and just excuse me, destroy her a la what they did to Peter Duesberg and you and all the others.
Book, if they did. In fact, I think I would encourage you to contact her and put you on her on your program.
I'd love
to
have
her. I'm trying to contact her, but I don't know how to do it.
Oh, we'll find her. We're good at that.
Yeah, I know.
We're investigative reporters.
Tell her Dave Rasnick would love to talk with her.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll make that happen. I wanted to, so Christine, I don't know, I don't want to cut off what you were just asking Dave about. Did we get to you were asking about, so categorically, Dave, chemo and radiation, always
no.
A bad bet. No, you place no stock in it whatsoever.
Zero. And the thing that was really surprising to me, even, is that these so-called targeted therapies that are all the rage now, these so-called immune therapies, I thought they'd probably be less toxic than these intentional poisons of chemo. They're turning out to be worse.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
No. And Dr. Azra Raza acknowledges that herself. They're worse.
So we have this kind of sanctified slaughter once again going on.
It is. And like I said, it's a $1 trillion industry. And it's not, the only thing the pharmaceutical industry knows how to do is make molecules. And molecules, you have to have a target. This was my business for many years, which is a protein or nucleic acid or something like that, that you synthesize these small molecules and interact with them. But there is no target for cancer. There's no protein, there's no gene. The notion of oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes and cancer genes, those are a fantasy. I use in my book the analogy of caloric and phlogiston back in the chemistry. They were supposedly the physical substances of heat or the physical substances of chemical reactions, but they aren't. They were totally mistaken. And the oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes are caloric and phlogiston of today.
So phlogiston was just like some kind of collective fantasy they had.
Yeah, I mean, it was a reasonable hypothesis at the time that turned out to be wrong.
But okay. How does all this, how do these drugs that don't work, how do these chemotherapies that are murderous, as you are implying, how do they get passed by the FDA? I mean, they have to show research. They have to show that, you know, there's a success rate of some kind, I would think. So what's going on here?
Well, the FDA, I hate to say it now, but it's part of the government. Right now, the whole government is just a big mess. The institutions are just so co-opted. And Congress helps it along. They pass legislation and things. Now, did you know most of the funding for the drug approval now for the FDA comes from the drug companies themselves, which makes the FDA working for the pharmaceutical companies? And they have this revolving door of the people that come.
That I know. Yes, but okay. Extra step to approve drugs that are killing people.
Let me tell you some things that sort of make sense. They never test these. Nobody's ever demonstrated that chemotherapy actually does more harm, more good than harm ever. It's never been demonstrated. All right. So what they do for cancer therapies, they assume that the chemotherapy and the radiation, they call them the standard therapies, are the best that they have to offer. So whenever any other drug or or targeted therapy or whatever, it's compared against another poison or targeted therapy. So you're just comparing one bad drug against another bad drug, and that's the standard. That's what they follow, but, and they just a routine. They just keep going on and on and on.
Where did it come from?
Approval of a drug can't be based on an assumption, can it? I mean,
oh, my Lord, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Most drugs are.
There's Christina thinks that science is full of science.
No,
I'm kidding.
I don't think that. But what I'm saying is, wouldn't there be, for example, a chemotherapy that we know does not work, and you know, in order for, you know, because the FDA, they're, oh, it's FDA approved. It means there have been all these double-blind studies, and here are the results of the studies, and here's the whole, here's the entire dossier on the research on this thing, and it's been approved because this percentage of the research shows that there's a 10% increased survival rate or a whatever. There has to be some there.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Exactly. So my point is, when you say there, it's passed on an assumption, I know our listeners, just like I'm going to say, well, they've got to approve it based on something. So there's something going on here in the approval process that's either being suppressed, hidden.
Well,
I don't know.
Let me try to pinpoint us on the map. But hang on one second, Dave. Let me just try to put us on the map at a certain the origins of chemotherapy and radiation. Right. I read recently they have shocking origins following World War II. Am I right? World War I. Okay, let's talk about that. Because this predates the FDA, and Christina's question is very good, but the origins of cancer treatment go further back. So let's go back there on the time map.
But before we even do that, let me tell you a great book. Clifton Leaf, the editor in chief of Fortune magazine, published a magnificent book in 2013 called "The Truth in Small Doses: Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It." Now, that will answer a lot of Christina's questions about that whole process, about the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry is not, or the FDA. The FDA basically is, it's broken. And you know what's even worse than the FDA is the EPA. The EPA has been eviscerated. It can't even do its job anymore. David Lewis, I don't know if you've heard of David Lewis, but he worked for the EPA, I think, for 30 years.
Yeah, I've interviewed him.
Okay, so, I mean, he tells the story about what happened, and I've got these things in my book, too, about these guys. I cite them and their work. The institutions, the science is not what people think it is. It's totally the movie version, the television version of science. And these institutions are total fantasy. That's not the way the world is right now.
Christina, it's predatory capitalism. Same story.
Right, right. Yeah. No, I understand that. I just want to know what the fig leaf is. I'm asking for, what is the fig leaf on this? I mean, if somebody were to sue them for murder, for example, like the chemotherapy, takes a chemotherapy and, you know, dies a terrible death, which is usually often what happens. If somebody were to sue
what would
them,
they claim
what
their evidence
would
is?
They offer?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Their defense, they don't even have to have that. Their defense is billions of dollars to throw at any opposition.
There's no magic study or touchstone where they say, here's where we showed chemotherapy saved lives. They don't even have that?
What they do with, like, a glyphosate, you may have heard of that.
We've done shows on it,
The EPA, which is totally corrupt now, unfortunately, they have good people working there, but they've been eviscerated by the law. That the EPA says glyphosate is probably not human carcinogen. They're the only ones that say that. You know,
I don't see how good people can be working there if that's going on. I'm sorry. You know, I've heard that so many times. They're great people at the FDA. It's just that the FDA... No, you're not great if you don't stand up and blow the whistle. No. That's how I feel.
No, I agree.
No, well, let me tell you something, though. I'm a bench scientist, I used to be, you know. The low-level scientists, I think they're rock solid. They go in there. They were like I was back in my younger days. I thought the people that had the biology figured out and I could just go and apply my skills as a chemist to go after their targets because I assumed that they got it right. They knew what caused arthritis. They knew what caused emphysema. They just need a drug for it. And I learned that they didn't have it right. They got it all wrong. You see, and a lot of the people, the lower level people there are really good, rock solid folks. It's the upper level, the corruption is at the highest levels, not the lowest levels. It's at the highest levels where the decisions are made.
David, am I right that this just floated back into my mind, that chemotherapy came from mustard gas?
Yes, that's right.
World War One.
So they had all this mustard gas and nothing, nobody to sell it to, crudely put.
I don't remember those exact details, but the thing is that cancer cells are so easy to kill. You know, fever will kill cancer cells. So it's not surprising that poisons will kill cancer.
But how did they go from mustard gas to calling to, like, how did it come into being, the cult of chemotherapy?
You know, I don't remember.
Okay.
I remember one story. I don't know, Celia, if you sent me that story about Marie Curie, the lady who discovered radiation. You know, they started.
Oh, Madame Curie. Yeah, Marie Curie.
Madame Curie. That's how you say it. Okay, right. Madame Curie, who discovered radiation and so on, and it became based on, I think, her science. This is going to kill cancer, and it was imposed upon people. And she herself died of radiation poisoning.
That's right.
You know.
Yeah, she died of cancer caused by she carried the thing of radium in her pocket for 30 years.
Exactly.
And also X-rays. You know, they use X-rays to treat cancer, but X-rays also cause cancer. That's one of the problems with mammograms.
So far,
millions of people, you know, with X-rays, you're causing cancer too.
Right. So
how about when you go through the machine at the airport?
I don't.
I don't either. You have to get there early.
I let them frisk me.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a free massage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a whole massive protocol, and it takes an extra half an hour, but I never go through those things.
They're not X-rays, by the way. They're microwaves, but microwaves also are carcinogenic.
Oh, God.
Well, Dave, I want to ask you now, but let's pull back a little bit. Aneuploidy theory, which you and Peter Duisberg, picking up from German scientist from the last century, Theodor Breviary.
Right.
So you two formalize an experiment, and you do the mathematical modeling, and you essentially posit, you give aneuploidy theory back to the world. And my understanding is that since you did that, the cancer establishment in the United States has, you could say, adopted, or you could say maybe quasi-stolen your model.
Co-opted,
okay. So this is now, if I were to call up the NCI, they told me in 1987 they would never take my calls because I had interviewed Peter Duisberg, so don't call here again, they told me, literally. But let's say I got through to the NCI and I said, what's the current model of cancer causation? Would they steer me in the direction of gene theory or aneuploidy theory?
Gene.
Okay. So it's not official yet, but tell us about the climate, the shift between genetic cancer and aneuploidy model.
Right. Yeah. Well, good old Theodor Breviary, probably one of the greatest scientists of the 19th century, early 20th century, came up with the chromosomal imbalance theory of cancer in 1914 in a little book that he wrote. Unfortunately, he died the next year, and it was also during World War One, and then that was followed by World War Two. And his magnificent theory sort of died on the vine. And then when everything sort of settled down after the Second World War, the United States now became the world's leading scientific power. And then we had the discovery that the Brits discovered the DNA in the early 1950s, and now we're moving into the molecular side of biology. And chromosomes are now becoming passé. And with Nixon's war on cancer in 1971, in the 70s, was also when genetic engineering was born. So now we have DNA, a molecule, we have genetic engineering, and they applied these new techniques. And also in the 70s, Peter Duisberg discovered the first cancer gene, oncogene. So all that happened in the 1970s, basically. With Nixon's war on cancer, genetic engineering, Peter's discovery of these oncogenes, what they are, and it all took off, and everybody went off their merry way thinking, oh, good, it's molecules, that we can deal with molecules that cause cancer. And that's where the whole United States, at least, view of what cancer is. It's the gene for this and the gene for that,
right,
basically. you know.
Right.
And so we're in the genetic craze era, basically.
The genetic craze era, absolutely. It's
everything's
like you
genetic.
So aneuploidy is not on the table at all right now?
Say it again, aneuploidy?
It's not on the table at all right now?
Only research. Only, like, I mean, you can publish on, you can do research on anything. But there's no emphasis in it. Not in the. There's a lot of it in China, in Japan. I'm sorry, Japanese have been interested in aneuploidy for quite some time, and in Europe, the United States has the least interest in terms of the government, the institutions, of any major country in the world. Matter of fact, we have the least interest in carcinogens in any major country in the world.
What do you mean?
Yes. We really do. We do not emphasize carcinogens at all in this country. The EPA can't really do anything about it. You look at the scientific publications about cancer. You hardly ever see the word carcinogen. It's about drivers, the gene drivers this, the gene drivers that, the mutations.
So they want everyone to get genetically tested and freaked out, but they don't want people to avoid carcinogens.
There's almost no talk of carcinogens in the scientific literature of cancer. Cancer scientific literature, carcinogens are virtually non-present in the literature.
I mean, that's absolutely crazy, especially these days when you see, you know, billion-dollar payouts to people because of the carcinogenic effects of glyphosates, for example. That's all starting now. So I don't understand why they're so ignored. I mean, clearly...
Billions of dollars.
It's all about the Benjamins. It's all about the Benjamins. That's crazy. It's nihilistic.
Well, I mean, it's just the powers that be. You know, I mean, it's the manufacturers of Roundup, the people that make chemotherapy, are the ones that make all these screening tests and everything. I mean, there's a lot of evidence now, a lot of evidence, and it's even accepted, even in the United States, these screens are actually need to pull back from them. They're dangerous, you know. But there's huge pressure from the people that have believed them and pushed them for decades that are fighting, and there's this feud going on in the United States right now between vested interests to keep mammograms versus pull back on them and so on and so forth.
Okay, what about this, Dave? So Nixon, first of all, I want to say this, that when Nixon coins this phrase, or his advertising agencies or whoever they were, the war on cancer is really when we have a whole new problem, which is the fact that we declare war on these diseases, right? And the health, so-called health agencies, are actually part of the military-industrial complex.
They are.
And the so-called treatments are literal, almost literally biological weaponry turned against humanity. So it's all so ultra-violent. And the idea that the body can be nourished back to health is just spat upon and despised.
It's not
because
American.
It's this war language, and it's all the media and the advertising agencies driving this. So it's like the way people have metaphors in their mind about what cancer is.
Yeah,
and that
we
got to get that word war out, and we've got to get the military-industrial complex, all these agencies, people don't realize, the CDC, the FDA, the NIH, the NCI, these are military organizations.
They are, and they're all linked. I mean, they're all of the piece. They all defend each other.
You know, I think it's important to address for our audience, like, since everybody is exposed to cancer. Everybody either has cancer, has had, as Gore Vidal once said to me, you know, you either are cancerous or you're pre, as he put it when I had a conversation with him about a long time ago. But, you know, when you do have cancer and you're terrified and you're going to the, you know, cancer center, local cancer center, and they're telling you, okay, you know, chemo, this, what do you tell a person like that to do?
Oh, well, I've had this conversation with lots of folks over the years, and what's really depressing is the people that call me up after they've gone through all of that stuff and they've been just totally destroyed by this stuff, and, you know, all you want to do is just shake your head. What can you do at that point? But I can tell you right now, for your listeners, I really want to plug Dr. Asra Raza's book, The First Cell. I mean, that is a great thing to lay your hands on and read that.
Okay.
Because she's, like I say, she's in the biz, and she's suffered. Her husband died of cancer, and God, she's so. This woman, you've got to put her on your program.
Okay.
But what I tell people is, you know, I just answer their specific questions. If they ask me, you know, about chemo or radiation, I say, don't do it. That's a mistake.
You cited Dr. Asra Raza extensively in your book, and tell me if I'm getting this right. Her husband, who died rather young, he also had a very strong belief that cancer would kill him, because he was an oncologist himself, so he saw it all the time, right? So isn't there something going on there as well with the mind over body?
Well, it might be, but I can't really
speak to that. Yeah.
Okay.
You know.
Well, because I feel like the constant terror that's waged on people about cancer is a big part of the problem.
I've got a story for you.
Okay.
Here's a story for you. All right. Bob Lepo, you know Bob Lepo.
Sure.
He's a good friend of Peter Duisberg, me and you, and he had some friends, and various people have come to me over the years. Because even though I'm not a physician, I know a lot about cancer, and they're just regular average citizens, and they have to go to their oncologist. This one particular woman had breast cancer, and she had it removed surgically, and that was very successful. And her oncologist wanted now to follow up with chemotherapy. She did not want to do it, and her husband was strongly supporting her. Her husband, very bright guy. I mean, he was not only an engineer, he was an architect. I think he had a PhD. He was a very nice guy, and he's very nice people. They go in there, and this oncologist, very affable fellow, shake your hand, jolly, you know, it makes you feel good. And he tries to talk her into taking chemo, and she says, you know, I really don't want to. And he gets a little stronger, a little more forceful, trying to put a little pressure on her to do this. And she just keeps fighting back, and then at some point he says something like this. I've heard it from either him or the other ones. Well, you want to live, don't you? Or you don't want to die, or something like that, you know. It's like, okay, take my word for it type of thing. And her husband, now this guy, he came in and tried to tone these things down, and he said, in his experience, he's learned that sometimes the best action is to do nothing. And, of course, then that's when the oncologist blew up, you know, to have his authority challenge. And you know, this whole thing, I didn't say a word the whole time. I was just there to give them moral support, and they took care of themselves just fine. And that's not a one-off thing. I've been in situations like that more than once. What people confront when they get in the medical profession, they're facing it, you know, really some serious problem, and that you're in there in the room with the doctor, the pressure the medical profession, these physicians, these MDs put on people to follow their instructions is amazing. It's absolutely incredible. You know, it made me want to fight.
You're
them.
Absolutely right. That is so key, what you said just there. I have a friend who had, she had breast cancer, and she had a mastectomy and breast replacement, and she was cleared and in the clear, and she was fine. She's still fine, thank God. But they wanted to put her on all kinds of experimental drugs, and oh boy, they had trials and things they wanted to press her into, and she knew she didn't want to do any of it. But she asked me to come with her to talk to these doctors, because she knew she would be, because of her upbringing, raised Catholic, she knew she would buckle.
Obey, obey,
and
obey.
And she asked me to get in between her and this doctor, which I did. And we got her out of there, and she didn't have to do it. But she is so interesting that she knew psychologically she wouldn't be able to stick up for herself and say what she wanted in the face of this man in the white coat. So that's a big part of the story. Dave, let's have the title. We have about between 3 and 4 minutes left. I do hope you'll come back again and talk to us, because this is a big can of worms we opened here.
It is.
And we only kind of touched touched on the basics, and there's so much to talk about here. But let's have the full title of your book soon to be published one more time? I know there isn't a publisher yet, but it will be published. What's the title?
If there's a publisher out there listening, give me a call. Anyway.
It's a great book. It's a great read.
The title is The Elephants in the Lab, A Personal Odyssey into the Essence of Cancer.
And you don't maintain a website right now or anything like that, right?
My own personal website, and the book under it's, I had crowdfunding. It was an Indiegogo thing. I think it was, 2018 or something like that, to help me fund writing this thing. And it was called The Nature of Cancer, and it's on there a little bit, but it's not very much stuff on there. And there's some videos, YouTube, you can click on there, things. I had to do some audio, video type things for the Indiegogo, that's stuff that's in the book, but it's, you know, just little snippets.
Yeah, you have some great talks online, actually. So for anybody listening, it's David Rasnick, R-A-S-N-I-C-K. You can go to YouTube and look him up. And David,
well,
it's
I want to tell you that I'm very, very grateful to you. I've had my own dance with cancer, and you know, your honesty is the difference. Whether you feel like you have not made an impact or not, I will tell you that it's people like you that, you know, one drop in the bucket at a time are going to save people from this thing.
You know what we have to do, too? We have to make doctors less fearful. They can lose their licenses if they go even a little bit. We have to help doctors. As much harm as they're doing, they're the scared. The only people that are a little bit more scared than physicians are some academics that I know. But we have to help these people because they're lost, man. Believe it or not.
So true, so true. Friends, we are out of time. Thank you for listening to the Whistleblower Newsroom. We'll see you next week.